Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. More than 900 people were shot in Baltimore last year, 301 of them fatally, the deadliest year in the city's history. The violence has barely abated. So far this year in Baltimore, more than 260 people have been fatally shot. The vast majority of the victims are young black men, and many of them end up at the University of Maryland R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center. What if there were a way to save more of their lives? A surgeon at Shock Trauma thinks he has found a way, but the technique is both controversial and ethically fraught. Freelance writer Nicola Twilley recently wrote about it for The New Yorker magazine in an article titled, "Can Hypothermia Save Gunshot Victims?" She joins us from her home in New York. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the technique, let's talk about the problem surgeons are trying to solve. You write that the cause of death for most people who sustain traumatic injuries is exsanguination cardiac arrest. What is that?
That's just the technical term for losing so much blood that there's too little left for your heart to continue pumping it around. And the reason you're losing that much blood is because you've got holes in you from the gunshot wounds. And your heart is just pumping and pumping, but the blood is flowing out of you. And gradually, as your heart ceases to be able to circulate and stops beating, you aren't getting enough oxygen then to your brain, and your brain dies too. So it's pretty much fatal. I mean, you have a 1 in 20 chance of making it at that point. And what's so frustrating about it for surgeons is that a lot of the time, those holes that are the reason you're losing all that blood, they're not that hard to fix. With just a little bit more time, surgeons could happily stitch those up and then you'd be fine. And these are oftentimes, you know, young, perfectly healthy folks. There just isn't enough time because you're losing blood so fast.
So the injuries themselves are not necessarily fatal. It's the blood loss.
That's right. I mean, it just keeps flowing out and your heart stops beating because there isn't enough blood to keep pumping around. And once your heart stops beating, they have to stop what they're doing, which was trying to fix all the holes, crack open your chest, try to get your heart going again. Every time they try to get your heart going again, even if they succeed, your electrolytes get out of whack, your blood stops coagulating, you get weaker and weaker every time. And most often, they'll lose you.
But why can't they just give a victim more blood, transfuse more blood to give them time to fix the wounds?
Because it's flowing out as fast as you're putting it in because of the holes.
So in your article, you introduce us to a professor of surgery at the University of Maryland named Sam Tischerman, who believes he's found a way to buy surgeons time in cases like these. Tell us about his technique.
Yeah, so it's a really sort of shocking idea. Once they get to the point where their heart stops and they crack open the chest, they do everything the same as normal up till there. But instead of trying to restart the heart, instead they're going to stick a cannula in and start pumping the person's circulatory system full of ice-cold saline. They end up pumping out all the blood. What little blood was left gets pumped out. And just keep pumping in gallons after gallons of ice-cold saline, and that takes the person's temperature down really, really fast.
Saline, salt water.
Saline is salt water, yeah. And it's really cold, and they're bringing down the patient's temperature to about 50 degrees centigrade, which if you got to that temperature just from being, you know, outside or you got locked in a freezer or something, chances are you would die. So it's very, very, very cold, and you have no blood left in your veins, just this ice-cold saline that they're pumping through you. You have no heartbeat, no pulse, no brain waves, but because it's cold, what it does is it stops your brain from dying. It just kind of hits the pause button on your brain. Your brain stops metabolizing so fast, stops sucking up oxygen, slows right down. And the surgeons have time to find all the holes, stitch them all up, and then reconnect you to blood and start warming you up slowly.
You use the phrase suspended animation. Clinically, is this death?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. A lot of doctors will tell you, oh, you're not dead until I say you're dead. I mean, technically, if no one has pronounced you dead, you're not. But at the same time, you pretty much, once you're in this state of suspended animation with just this ice water in your veins, you have all the signs of a dead person. You have no brain waves, no pulse, no heartbeat, no blood, obviously. So it's more or less indistinguishable from death, other than they're going to try to resuscitate you afterward.
And what is this technique called?
It's called EPR. That's short for Emergency Preservation and Resuscitation. And I should say, the idea is that you are going to be able to spend as much as 60 minutes in this suspended animation state, too. So it's not just sort of 5 minutes while they quickly do everything. It could be as much as an hour. And then they gradually warm you up really slowly over a couple-day period.
This is On the Record. On WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. I'm talking with New Yorker magazine contributor Nicola Twilley about an article she recently wrote titled, "Can Hypothermia Save Gunshot Victims?" How controversial among trauma surgeons is EPR, Emergency Preservation and Resuscitation?
Well, so there's a couple of things that are controversial about it. First of all, the dogma on the trauma ward is letting your patient get cold is bad. And actually, it is true that statistically, patients that get mild hypothermia in the trauma ward are more likely to die. They start shivering. The hypothermia causes their blood to be less able to clot. It starts this sort of downward spiral. And so cold has often been seen as a bad thing. The difference with EPR, with emergency preservation and resuscitation, is that you get cold really, really fast. So you skip that shivering stage. It doesn't matter that your blood's not coagulating because you have no blood left. So it's sort of a whole different way of thinking for trauma surgeons. There are lots that are very excited about it, and equally some that are very unsure as to whether it will work. And that's the other controversial part, because this hasn't been tried on humans yet.
Right, and I want to ask you about testing. But first, there have been situations of accidents where people's temperatures have fallen drastically and they have survived. It's kind of seen as miraculous.
Yeah, I mean, you do get these one-off cases in the literature, so where people will, you know, fall into an Arctic pond while they're skiing, or a toddler will fall into a frozen swimming pool, and they can be pulled out 20 minutes, 40 minutes later and make a complete recovery. And obviously, they haven't had any oxygen during that time. They've been underwater. So the theory has been that they've been saved by the cold, that they were basically flash frozen like a piece of cod, and that they can be warmed up slowly and brought back to life. So there are these examples. They're examples that have, you know, been written up as accidents.
And so this hypothermia technique, emergency preservation and resuscitation, has not been tested on humans in any kind of formal way. Researchers have been trying it out on animals for a long time.
That's right. For decades. I mean, the idea has been floating around since the 50s. Sam Tischerman, the surgeon at Shock Trauma, has been working on it since the late 80s himself. This particular technique actually came out of studying the combat casualties in the Vietnam War and realizing, look, if we want to save these soldiers, we just have to find a way to buy more time. We have to slow their biological clock. We can't save any more people than we currently are doing with our current techniques unless we have more time. And so Dr. Tischerman, working with colleagues in Pittsburgh at the time, spent years and years trying this on large dogs, seeing how cold they could go, how long they could stay in suspended animation, how were their brains when they came back, because there's obviously no point doing this if it doesn't actually protect someone's brain, because even if you do get them back that way, there's no quality of life. When it started to seem like it was working, other scientists joined in, did tests on pigs. I've actually seen those videos, and it's somewhat astonishing. You see the pigs, and as they get cooled, their flesh just turns from pink to white. And then they're in the videos 2 weeks later, snuffling at their food and successfully navigating a maze.
You mentioned a minute ago that brain damage is a concern when you're lowering body temperatures so drastically. But how do they test an animal for brain damage after an experiment like this?
Right, that is the difficult part. But obviously one way is to kill the dog or pig and dissect it and look at its brain, but actually two of the researchers created a memory test. And so before the pigs were injured and operated on, they were shown these food-filled boxes in different colors, and only one of them could be unlatched. And so then the pigs are killed, chilled, resuscitated, and then the pigs are put back in the maze. And the trick is, can they remember that it's the blue plastic box that they can open and get the food? And so, you see these videos of the pigs going straight to the blue box, flipping it open, eating as happily as they did before.
That's Nicola Twilley here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the article she wrote in The New Yorker magazine titled, Can Hypothermia Save Gunshot Victims? Scientists were ready to test this hypothermia approach on humans, you write, by 2002. What's taken so long?
There's a few reasons for that. One is funding, actually. This is not the type of sort of pharmaceutical that a drug company is going to be excited about monetizing. So finding the funding, which eventually came from the Department of Defense, that was a challenge. Finding the right hospitals who were prepared to do this. You know, this really takes a level one trauma center. You have to be on top of your game. The main hurdle that has slowed this down is actually the ethical concerns, because obviously the patients who are going to get this new technique tried on them, they can't give consent ahead of time. By definition, at the point at which they will be given this treatment, they've basically just died. So there's no way to ask for their consent, and there's no time to ask for their family's consent either, because it has to be done right away for it to work. And, you know, most of the time people's families aren't going to get to the hospital as quickly as the gunshot victim, and you certainly can't explain the whole process and how it works in enough time. So you have to do this thing called waived consent trials, and the FDA does allow that for trauma research in particular, because trauma research is, you have this kind of problem in a lot of situations that you would never be able to develop new treatments if you only could do them on people who had consented. So the pathway does exist. It just takes an awful lot of jumping through hoops and showing the FDA and the Department of Defense and the hospital's own internal review board that you have done as much as you can to make this an ethical trial.
Since, as you point out, there are other techniques that have come along in emergency medicine where that consent needed to be waived for the new technique to be tested, and that's happened before. Is this more complicated?
Yeah, this particular situation, there's another wrinkle, I think, because on the surface, it seems sort of reasonable. You can't ask for consent, so you have to do this waived consent process. But the problem is the population that shock trauma is going to be treating with this trial are, as you said at the start of the show, you know, mostly young Black males, mostly from West Baltimore. And this is a population that is already discriminated against in so many ways that to then make them essentially the guinea pigs in a medical trial, that's where it starts to feel a little less ethically straightforward. Now, the way that the hospital has gone about this is to do a community consultation process. And they have gone out to malls and libraries and violence prevention programs and things, set up a table, talked with folks about what the treatment is, how it might work, what their concerns are, etc. So they have gone through this process, but you can imagine that doesn't alert everyone that this might apply to about what might happen to them or give them a chance to opt out. There is an opt-out mechanism. If you don't want this done to you, if you get shot, you can actually request a rubber bracelet. It's a red one, and it says no to EPR CAT. And if you get that and then you get shot, you will not have this done to you. So there is an opt-out, but really, I would say that there's absolutely zero chance that the people who will first have this technique tried on them will have actually heard about it and have had the chance to opt out, really.
Well, I appreciate your walking us through it. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Freelance writer Nicola Twilley wrote an article titled, "Can Hypothermia Save Gunshot Victims?" for the November 28th issue of The New Yorker magazine. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. When we come back, we'll hear from a medical ethicist who wrote a book about the history of medical experimentation on African Americans. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about a new technique developed by a surgeon at the University of Maryland's R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center. It's called EPR, Emergency Preservation and Resuscitation. It involves drastically lowering the body temperature of gunshot victims to prevent death by blood loss. It's been cleared for clinical trials, but the technique is ethically fraught. How do you obtain consent from someone who is losing precious blood with every passing minute? Before the break, we talked with New Yorker magazine contributor Nicola Twilley, who wrote an article about EPR last month. Now we turn to Harriet Washington, a medical ethicist and the author of Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. She joins us by phone. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you, Sheila. I'm very happy to be here.
I'm very glad to have you. Harriet Washington, the first patients undergoing this new technique will likely be young Black men, given the population shock trauma serves. You wrote a book recounting the history of medical experimentation on African Americans. Lack of consent is a big part of that history. Give us some examples.
Well, there are a myriad of examples. All the way from the 17th century, there's a tolerance for a lot more experimentation during treatment then. And some physicians took full advantage of that, doing horrible things like taking Black people who had typhus, only Black people, and pouring boiling water on them as a supposed treatment, saying things like, oh, it might help restore the circulation. And then you had people who were brought into clinics, which often agreed to treat Black people and enslave people free. They kept these people in the clinic, not treating them, but using them as examples for the training of medical students, going so far as to remove healthy limbs in order to show a medical student, here's how you amputate a leg, here's how you amputate an arm. And then we had people like Dr. James Marion Sims in Alabama, who was treating, and I use the term advisedly, who was treating a horrible condition called vesicovaginal fistula by doing repeated experimental operations on the genitalia of, again, only Black women, see if you could find a way to sew up the holes in their reproductive system. After he succeeded in doing this, he immediately went north and began treating white women, but unlike the Black women, he extracted their permission first. So from the beginning, Black subjects and Black patients were treated differently. The real problem was that no consent at all was sought. So we had a disparate treatment from the very beginning. The fact is we still see remnants of this in things like pain control, with African Americans not getting adequate pain control.
Nicola Twilley spoke with you for her New Yorker article about emergency preservation and resuscitation. What are your thoughts about the EPR trial?
There is a very important historical context for this trial. It's not a new approach. It's something that was enabled by a law passed in 1996. The Code of Federal Regulations, for the first time, presented a framework by which researchers could avoid getting the consent of research subjects. This is really a portentous act. It's actually quite horrifying if you know medical research history. The first tenet of the Nuremberg Code is that the voluntary consent of the subject is absolutely essential. Dr. Andrew Ivey said, consent is what separates the allowable from the criminal. And I happen to think that he's right. This is not the first research like this. There have been at least 20 that I know about in detail, and they've all had some of the same failings. And despite the rosy promises, most of them have resulted in worse health and in greater injury to people who are in the research, for which they never gave their consent.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm talking with medical ethicist Harriet Washington about a controversial new emergency room technique involving intentionally subjecting gunshot victims to hypothermia to allow time for surgery. Let me go through with you what the University of Maryland surgeon who's heading this research, Sam Tischerman, is doing in terms of outreach in the community to help make up for the fact that patients would not be asked for their consent. He has set up informational booths in shopping malls, an opt-out bracelet that would be worn by those who have decided they don't want the procedure done to them. So he's taken out ads in newspapers. Do you see this range of activities as sufficient?
They're certainly not sufficient in that they're not any substitute for consent. Early on, this kind of community consultation was called community consent. They had to change the name because it's misleading. When they give this information, they don't give it to everybody who's going to be affected in the area. Only a small minority of people will ever attend these sessions. There's no provision for getting feedback, taking note of objections. If they had a meeting like this, and most of the people who attended objected to it, that would not change the research. And also, the bracelets are the very common form of supposedly compensating for consent, but that's not, because the fact is, not everybody is going to know about the study. You can't get a bracelet if you don't know the study's transpiring. Have they given any thought to ways in which you might obtain real consent? No. I see no evidence of that.
Tell me how you think they should be proceeding to be ethical.
If you're talking about looking for people who are at high risk of suffering a trauma, those people can be identified. It sounds a bit ghoulish, but it's not as ghoulish as denying people consent to research. This can be done, but there's been no attempt to do so.
Nicola Twilley notes in her New Yorker article that only 1 in 20 patients with the kinds of wounds this technique is meant for currently survive. What would you say to those who would argue that they would think families of those patients would want them to be saved by any means necessary, even if they had not in advance given consent?
The real question is not what I would say to them. The question is, what would they say? Would people want to be in research in which no one had asked their permission? And we already know the answer. The fact is, people don't in general agree to be in research without consent. There isn't any data showing that this is what people want. And there's something else going on here that I think is very important, and that is that there is a confusion, a conflation of research and treatment. The language in which the study is couched makes it sound like we're talking about an emergency treatment. But we don't need a research study to treat people in emergencies. This is only necessary to conduct research. It's a very important distinction, because your status as a patient gives you rights that you don't have as a subject. And so by confusing research and treatment, we're doing subjects a disservice. I don't think it's too much of an exaggeration to say that you're lying to the subject when you tell them that we are doing this emergency research in order to treat you in an emergency. That's not what's going on.
Would your approach to this question be any different if these trials were done on a different population without this troubled history of experimentation that you've detailed in one of your books?
This research is unethical with any group of people. The fact that they're African Americans does not make it unethical. The fact that it deprives people of the right to say yes or no to research is what makes it unethical. We have to remember that these are untested modalities. Conducting research on people without asking their permission is something that we have condemned ever since Nazi Germany. And by the way, in Dachau, freezing experiments were conducted in which people were subjected to hypothermia and actually were killed by immersing them into freezing water.
I really appreciate your walking us through the way you look at this. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Harriet Washington is a medical ethicist and the author of Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. Earlier, we heard from New Yorker contributor Nicola Twilley. We have a link to her article, as well as to Harriet Washington's book, on the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for listening. Tune in tomorrow.